fearful aggression can be to a dog. Give affection, but at the right time. This is as good a time as any to stop and remind you, yet again, of one of the most common ways we screw up our dogs and give them issues. We share affection, but at the wrong times. We give affection when the dog's mind is the most unstable. This is often the hardest advice for my clients to hear. Hold back affection. It's not natural. Please don't misunderstand me. Love is a beautiful thing, and one of the greatest gifts we can share with our dogs. But it's not the most important thing they need, especially if they have issues. If you're unstable, you can't really experience love. You aren't able to feel it. Love doesn't help an unstable dog. Aggressive dogs are not healed because their owners love them, any more than an abusive husband will be healed if his wife, his victim, simply loves him more. Those parents on Nanny 911, of course they love their children, but love's the only thing they're giving. They're not giving their kids exercise. They're not giving them psychological stimulation. There are no rules. Are those kids having a good time? No. That's why their parents called the nanny. Unstable dogs aren't having a good time either, even though they're often much loved by their owners. That's why their owners call me. Love is not meant to enhance instability. Love is meant to reward stability, to take us to a higher level of communication. Just like in the human world, in the dog world, love means something only if it's earned. I would never tell people to stop loving their dogs, or to love them less, or in any way to measure the love they give them. Give your dog as much love as you have. Give as much love as your heart can handle, and then some. But please, give it at the right time. Share affection to help your dog, not just to fulfill your own needs. Giving love at the right time, and only the right time, is a way you can truly prove your love for your dog. Actions speak louder than words. Fearful aggression doesn't come out of nowhere. It is carefully tended like a garden by unknowing and well-meaning owners. Another example of a fearful, aggressive dog is Josh, whom the writers on my television show nicknamed the Grooming Gremlin for his long, eye-concealing hair. Josh was a shelter dog that no one would adopt. He would bare his teeth at anyone who passed by his cage. Everybody who came into the shelter felt sorry for Josh. Everybody. Feeling sorry for an animal in a shelter is something most people do. Sympathy is only human. But when 50 people go to a shelter, and all of them send that soft, sympathetic, "Oh, the poor dog," energy to an animal, that energy eventually becomes who that animal is. It defines him. Ronette, a nurse, felt so sorry for Josh that she adopted him on the spot. Then she proceeded to continue to feel sorry for him every day. When he snarled at her daughter for approaching his food dish, Ronette would scoop him up and comfort him, as if her daughter were the offending party. When he attacked the professional groomers so often that he was banned from the place, she'd spend hours grooming the crotchety little fellow who would not allow scissors near his eyes. Believe it or not, I've been bitten by very few dogs in my career. Josh turned out to be one of them. He bit me while I was grooming him, but I continued on as if nothing had happened. He had to learn that a human was not going to back down, no matter how aggressive he became. Being a little dog, he was more snarl than nip, and more nip than bite. He surrendered, and today Josh can go to the groomers without drawing blood. I use both Pinky and Josh as examples because I want to stress that feeling sorry for a dog is not doing that dog a favor. It is actually hurting her chances of becoming balanced in the future. Imagine if someone felt sorry for you all the time. How would that make you feel about yourself? Dogs need leadership before they need love. Let love reward balance. That's how balance is maintained. How do you deal with fearful aggression? You don't give in. You have a choice. Either wait out the dog and let her come to you, or go in and get her. If you go in and get her, you have to follow through. You simply cannot let her win. You must remain calm and assertive, and you can't get angry. Remember, at all times, that you are doing this for the good of the animal. Patience is the key. Waiting it out. Man is the only animal that doesn't seem to understand patience. Wolves wait for their prey. Crocodiles wait. Tigers wait. But especially here in America, we're used to drive-throughs, FedEx, and high-speed internet. You cannot rush the rehabilitation of a dog with fearful aggression. You may have to go in and get that dog 50, 100 times before it sinks in. I have a couple of fearful dogs at the center that I know I'll be getting out of corners again and again and again until they finally come to understand that only calm submission will be rewarded. With Pinky, the fearful, aggressive pit bull, the moment I put my 35-cent leash on her, she relaxes. That's the nature of a follower. She wants to be told what to do. If I walk with her only a few feet, she begins to show all the physical signs of calm submission. She relaxes and calms down. If I wait too long before telling her what I want her to do next, the body language changes again. The tail goes between the legs. The shaking starts. No amount of affection is going to help this dog. In this case, affection contributed greatly to her problem. When do I give Pinky affection? The moment I see her relax when we walk with the leash. I will continue to do that until she is rehabilitated. Dogs can become aggressive as a result of fear, dominance, possessiveness, territoriality, and a slew of other reasons, and aggression varies in degrees. In the next chapter, we'll talk about what I call the red zone. Red zone cases, extreme chronic aggression, should always be referred immediately to a professional. Never attempt to handle a dog like this yourself, but you need to gauge your own degree of comfort. If your dog is only as aggressive as Josh, but you don't trust yourself to handle the situation, please err on the side of safety. Call in a professional dog trainer or animal behaviorist for the good of both you and your dog. Hyperactive energy. Does your dog jump all over you when you come home? Do you think it's just because your dog is happy to see you and has spirit? Do you look at this behavior as your dog's personality? It's not spirit or personality. Hyperactive energy, overexcitement, isn't natural for a dog. It's not healthy. In dogs' natural state, they do get excited and do play with one another. But excitement has a time and place. After a hunt, or after they've eaten, they have what is like a celebration, which we interpret as affection. They can and do play rough with one another, becoming excited submissive or excited dominant. But they don't practice excited behavior for a long time, and they don't practice excitement with that hyperactive panting sound you get with an overexcited domestic dog. That is a different type of excitement, a kind of crazy excitement. Some dogs in America seem to be in a state of hyper-excitement all the time, and it's not good for them. I've noticed that my clients often interpret the words happiness and excitement as the same thing. She's just happy to see me. The two aren't the same. A happy dog is alert. Her ears are up, her head is up, and her tail is wagging. An overexcited dog is jumping up, panting, and can't stop moving around. This is pent-up energy. Hyperactively energetic dogs are often among the hardest cases to rehabilitate. Hyperactive energy fosters other issues as well, such as fixation and obsession. When their dogs jump on them at the door when they come home, many of my clients greet them with lots of affection. First of all, if your dog is jumping on you, that's an act of dominance. Don't allow it. Dogs are naturally curious, and they'll obviously be interested when someone comes to the door of your house. But they need manners to greet visitors with. Dogs don't greet other dogs by jumping all over them. They greet one another by sniffing. If that etiquette is good enough for the dog world, it's certainly good enough for your home. Keep your dog leashed when visitors come to your home while you're teaching her how to greet visitors politely. Once you feel you are making visible progress, ask your guests to help you out. Instruct them not to acknowledge your jumping, overexcited dog. No talk, no touch, no eye contact, until she has calmed down. When a dog is being ignored, it sometimes calms down in mere seconds. Hyperactive dogs need exercise, and a lot of it, and they need it before they get affection. When you come home, take your dog for a long walk, then feed her. You have provided her with a physical and psychological challenge, followed by a reward of food. Then later, when her mind is calm, give her affection. Don't encourage the crazy jumping behavior, even if it seems fun for you and makes you feel loved. I'm sorry, but all that fuss is not because your dog is happy to see you. It's because she has too much pent-up energy, and she's got to release it somehow. Anxiety, separation anxiety. Anxiety can contribute to hyperactive energy. You don't see a lot of anxiety in nature. Fear, yes. Anxiety, no. It's only when we bring animals into the home or cage them up that we create anxiety in them. Anxiety can cause the kind of whimpering, whining, howling separation anxiety that Oprah's dog Sophie used to experience every time Oprah went away. For dogs to be concerned about separation from you is normal. It is instinctual for them to worry or be sad if the pack is broken up, even if that pack consists of only you and your dog. And it's not natural for a dog to be shut up in a house or apartment alone all day with nothing to do. Your dog can't read a book or do a crossword puzzle or watch my television show. Her energy has nowhere to go while you're gone. No wonder so many American dogs experience separation anxiety and end up with all that built-up hyperactive energy when their owners return home. By the way, when you return home to find that your dog has eaten your favorite pair of shoes, it's not because she's mad at you for leaving and knew you loved those shoes. There you go, humanizing your dog again. Your dog ate your shoes because of her bottled-up energy. First, she smelled your shoes. They smelled familiar, like you. Smelling the shoes and reacting to your familiar scent, she got excited. Once she got excited, she had to release all that energy and anxiety. So, she unleashed it all on your unlucky shoes. I find that owners often don't recognize symptoms of anxiety in their dogs. They think that the separation anxiety begins when they leave the house. But in reality, it starts with unreleased energy that has been building since the moment their dog woke up. An owner wakes up, brushes his teeth, drinks a cup of coffee, and makes breakfast. And all the while, his dog is in the background, following him room to room, pacing. The owner thinks, "Oh, she just loves to be with me. She has to make sure I'm fine all the time." All this is a fiction the human creates in his mind in order to feel good. That dog is showing you not how much she loves you, but how anxious she is. If you leave the house without giving her some way to release that energy, of course she'll have separation anxiety issues. I tell my clients to take their dogs for a good long walk, run, or even a rollerblade session first thing in the morning. That's good for the human's health, too. If you absolutely can't do that, put the dog on a treadmill while you're eating breakfast or putting on your makeup. Really tire her out. Then it's feeding time. By the time you leave the house, your dog will be tired and full, and in a naturally resting state. The mind will be calm, submissive, and it will make much more sense for her to be quiet for the rest of the day. You'll also be less likely to have a hyperactive dog greet you at the door. Another piece of advice is not to make a big deal out of coming and going. If you share excited energy when you come and go, it only feeds an anxious mind. Obsessions, fixations. Another possible outcome for a dog's unreleased energy results in the dog's becoming fixated on or obsessed with something. It could be anything from a tennis ball to the cat, but it's not natural, and it's not good for your dog. A fixation is wasted energy. A dog needs to channel her energy into something in order to be balanced and calm, submissive. A dog living with a homeless person walks all day, so that's where the energy goes. A dog that lives with a disabled person has the physical, psychological challenge of keeping her owner safe, which is another way the dog releases her energy. Owners who run and walk with their dogs on a regular basis help their dogs drain energy. Many owners feel that if they open the back door of their house, their dog will get enough of a workout by following a squirrel around the yard. A squirrel that 99% of the time the dog will never catch, so the dog spends all day just looking up at the squirrel in the tree, becoming fixated on a squirrel that doesn't give a damn about the dog. Have you ever seen an anxious squirrel? The only one who is going nuts is the dog. All her energy is concentrated on the squirrel. That's one way of creating a fixation. Another way is allowing a dog simply to sit and stare at a cat or bird or any other animal in the house. Because the dog is not biting, barking, or growling, the owner thinks it's okay. But being in a fixated mode is not normal for a dog. The dog's eyes will be focused, her pupils will be dilated, and sometimes the dog will drool. The body language will be tense. If the owner gives the dog a command when it is in this fixated mode, the dog won't respond. Her ears won't even twitch in recognition of her owner's voice. When the owner takes a dog to the dog park and it runs back and forth, compulsively chasing smaller dogs, it's not playing. That's not a game. That's fixation. Even if it doesn't come to a bite this time, a fixation like this is serious because it can escalate into the red zone. Another kind of fixation is when a dog obsesses or fixates on a toy or activity. Ever meet a dog who goes insane over a tennis ball, begging you to throw the ball again and again and again until you want to pull your hair out? Many owners think they can substitute taking a dog out to play fetch for giving him regular walks. That doesn't work. Yes, it's exercise, but not the kind of primal activity that migrating with a pack leader provides. I like to compare it to taking the kids to Chuck E. Cheese's versus taking them to piano lessons. Chuck E. Cheese's will have them bouncing off the walls. That's excitement. Piano lessons will be a psychological challenge. That's calm submission. Playing catch is excitement. A walk is calm submission. If an owner skips the walk and just plays with the dog will have to use that playtime as the only way to totally drain her energy. The dog is being given that activity while her mind is anxious and excited. She'll play until she drops, which will be long after the owner does. At the same time, she'll go into the kind of high gear she would never reach naturally. When wolves or feral dogs hunt, they're very organized. They're calm. They're not fixated on what they're hunting. Focused, yes. Fixated, no. One is a natural state. The other is not. The problem is, owners often see fixations as cute or funny, or they describe them as love. She just loves that frisbee. He just adores playing with that ball. That's not a healthy kind of love. A fixation is just like an addiction in a human and can be just as dangerous. Think of a gambling addict in Las Vegas, sitting there all night, pouring coins into a slot and pulling that one-armed bandit for hours on end. That's a fixation. Smoking, drinking, anything that you can't control, and where there are no limits, then you're in a fixated mode. You're not in control anymore. In this case, the ball controls the dog, or the cat controls the dog, or the squirrel controls the dog. Some dogs can become so fixated on an object that they will bite or attack another dog or a person who tries to take that object away from them. If you don't watch out, you're heading for the red zone. At the Dog Psychology Center, if we're going to play with a ball, I make sure that before we do, everybody's quiet. If I'm going to feed the dog's dinner, first, everybody's quiet. If I'm going to give affection, first, everybody's quiet. I never give anything to the dogs if their minds are not calm, submissive. That's how I make a fixated dog become normal, because he never gets anything if he's in that state. That's how I can have 50 dogs playing with the same ball without anybody getting hurt. We also never play or eat without doing some sort of vigorous exercise, walking, running, or rollerblading first. Draining energy is vital. Dogs with fixations try our patience. Most people try to reason with their dogs verbally when they're fixated on an object, such as a favorite toy or a tennis ball. Then this escalates to orders. Now, leave it. Leave it. Leave it. Leave it. Leave it. That only creates more excited and unstable energy for the animal. By this time, the human is already frustrated and angry at the dog, because the dog hasn't heard a word he's been saying for the past 10 minutes. Then, the owner makes the decision to grab the dog physically and pull the object away. Now he's projecting so much unstable, frustrated energy that the dog's fixation only gets worse. Uncrossing Jordan. The most physically exhausting case I handled in the first season of my television show was that of Jordan the Bulldog and his multiple obsessions. Jordan's owner, Bill, had specifically wanted a calm, low-energy, lazy bulldog. Jordan certainly seemed quiet when Bill picked him out of the litter, but he grew up to be a hyperactive, dominant, and obsessive fixated dog. He would fixate on a skateboard, a basketball, a garden hose, really pretty much any object that was within reach. He'd take that object in his mouth and never let go. Bill and his family did the number one worst thing to do with an animal that's got an object of fixation in its mouth. They played tug of war with Jordan. By trying to pull the ball or the skateboard away from the dog, they were activating his prey instinct, making him go even crazier. Bill's energy didn't help much either. Patience is a virtue when it comes to a fixated mind. Of course, so is calm, assertive energy. Bill seemed like a laid-back, easy-going guy on the surface, but underneath, he was actually very tense and easily frustrated. Remember when I said that energy doesn't lie? Bill wasn't fooling Jordan. His passive-aggressive, frustrated energy was mirrored in Jordan's obsessions. When rehabilitating dogs, it's usually easier for me to remove a dominant, aggressive state of mind than a hyperactive, fixated state of mind. Jordan was no exception. I started with a skateboard. Because bulldogs usually get hot and worn out easily, I figured it wouldn't take much for me to drain Jordan's energy. He would prove me very wrong. That bulldog was one determined little fellow. With each object, instead of pulling the object away from him, I challenged him to back away from it, thus claiming the object for myself. Every time he moved forward, I corrected him with a tug. This eventually sends a signal to the brain that what I want is submission. I went forward instead of moving away from him, and I stayed with that same calm, assertive energy until Jordan finally got it. But because he had been living in that fixated state for so long, it wasn't easy. I was dripping with sweat by the end of the session. Working with Jordan's owner, Bill, was my next task. I had to get Bill to understand his part of the equation. He needed to become more patient and to practice being calmer and more assertive. I truly believe, and it has been my experience, that animals are put into our lives for a purpose, to teach us lessons and to help us become better people. Jordan was certainly pushing all of Bill's buttons. Perhaps if Bill had found himself a lower energy, mellower dog, he wouldn't have been challenged to change. Bill loved Jordan, and he was motivated to become a more balanced person so that Jordan could be a more balanced bulldog. A fixated or obsessive dog needs an outlet for her pent-up energy, which begins with the walk. She also needs an owner who will be there to snap her out of it the moment she begins to fixate. You can't wait until she's already into the fixated mode. And you'll know that mode when you see it. Her body language will change, and she'll stiffen. Her pupils will dilate. When this happens, she needs to be brought back to a calm, relaxed state immediately with an appropriate correction. I advised Bill to go for a good long walk to tire Jordan out, then to put the object in front of him and make sure he didn't go for it. If a dog's problem has been going on a long time, you're going to need to do this again and again and again, perhaps for months if the fixation is really bad. It's as they say in AA, one day at a time. If you've consistently been doing negative things in your life, smoking, drinking, overeating, you have to practice consistency in replacing those things with positive activities. Rehabilitating a fixated obsessive dog may seem like a lot of work, and it can be, but we owe it to our dogs to put in this kind of effort in order for them to become balanced. Phobias. You remember Cain, the Great Dane who was afraid of shiny floors? That's a classic example of a phobia. A dog can develop a phobia for just about anything, from a certain pair of boots to another animal to an entire gender of people. Phobias are, very simply, fears that the dog has not been able to move beyond. If a dog's mind isn't allowed to move forward after a fear-inspiring incident, that fear can become a phobia. In the natural world, an animal learns from fear. A wolf learns to avoid traps. A cat learns not to play with snakes. But animals don't make a big deal out of the things that scare them. They don't lose sleep over them. They experience the emotion, learn from it, and then move on with their lives. We humans create phobias for them by the way we react to their fears. We keep them stuck. Marina, Cain's owner, made a huge fuss when Cain slipped on the shiny floor that first time. Then she made the mistake of comforting him whenever he was near the object of his phobia. Even if we don't know the cause of a dog's phobia, guess what will either cause or intensify any phobia there is? You guessed it. Once again, it's giving affection at the wrong time. When a child is afraid and we comfort him and give him affection and love, that's human psychology. When a dog is afraid and we comfort her and give her affection and love, that's also human psychology, not dog psychology. A dog wouldn't show affection to another dog that was afraid. The correct response to a dog's phobia is to show leadership. First, drain the dog's energy, since a phobia is a kind of reverse obsession. The same principles apply. If a dog is tired and relaxed, she's much less likely to be phobic and much more responsive to a strong pack leader who will help her move past her fears. Low self-esteem. Self-esteem isn't an issue, but it does play a part in many of the dog problems that I come across. When I refer to self-esteem in a dog, I'm not talking about what the dog thinks about how he looks or whether he's popular or not. Self-esteem in a dog, to me, relates to energy, dominance, and submission. Dogs with low self-esteem are submissive, weak-energy, weak-minded dogs who may suffer from fears, panic, or phobias. They often exhibit anxiety. They may show fear-aggressive behavior, like Josh or Pinky, or they may simply be terminally shy. Dogs with low self-esteem can also develop obsessions, but in a different way than the way a dominant, energetic dog like Jordan developed his. Take Brooks, an Entlebucher. When Brooks was a puppy, he was very timid. After being bitten by a neighbor's dog, he became even more afraid. He would cower and slink away whenever anyone tried to pet him. Having low self-esteem, he felt as if everyone were coming after him, and he was afraid. Then, one day, someone played a game of chase with him using a laser pointer, one of those pen-shaped tools that send a beam of light across the room. This became a game Brooks really loved because he had a chance to chase something. Something was running away from him for a change. He felt a little bit dominant over something and good about himself, and all the energy that he had stored up in his insecurities could be released while he chased after the light. From that point on, Brooks became obsessed with light. He was constantly being distracted by rays of sunlight, by reflections, by patterns of light and shade on the ground. His owners, Lorraine and Chuck, couldn't even take him on a walk without Brooks running off and chasing after whatever stray reflection came along. In Brooks's mind, light became his only way to release pent-up energy. To insecure Brooks, the light was something that he could try to control. It never chased after him. It always moved away from him. This was an obsession created directly by both lack of physical exercise and by Brooks's low self-esteem. Unlike high-level energy and dominant Jordan, Brooks was a weak-minded, submissive dog. So snapping him out of his obsession took me less than 5 minutes. I only had to tug on his leash a handful of times before he got it. Of course, his owners would have to continue correcting him, consistently, each time he began to go into fixated mode. But it wasn't long before his obsession became a distant memory. There are dogs whose self-esteem is at what I call rock bottom. Dogs like Pinky. They are stuck in their insecurity. Instead of fight or flight, they freeze up. They'll hide. They won't move. They'll shake. They simply can't move forward in whatever they need to do. They won't get better on their own. They need a human to help them. Dogs with low self-esteem are desperately looking for a pack leader. They want to be told what to do. That's sometimes the only time they'll relax, as in Pinky's case. Such dogs respond well to rules, boundaries, and limitations. The power of the pack will help them get better faster. Being around her own kind is powerful therapy for a dog with low self-esteem, but her time in the pack must be closely supervised at first because of all dogs' natural instinct for attacking weakness. Little by little, these dogs get better, but they need strong guidance from their human pack leader. One last word about self-esteem. A domestic dog's self-esteem shouldn't be too high either. In nature, only the pack leader gets to strut around with his tail up and his chest forward, projecting dominant energy to the others. If you're the pack leader with your dog, then only you get to do that in your house. When I come to a house where all the humans are tiptoeing around the dog, where the dog is the bully and everybody answers to her, then I know that dog should feel a little less proud of herself. Becoming pack leader over a dominant dog means taking her down a peg. That definitely doesn't mean physical abuse or humiliating her in any way. And remember, she's not going to resent you for taking the lead. She might resist a little at first, to see how much she can get away with, but she won't take offense once you prove to her that your energy is more powerful than hers. Prevention. All of the issues I've presented here can be prevented if you remember to treat your dog like a dog, not a human. And you make it a priority to work to fulfill your dog's life as much as she fulfills yours. In Chapter 7, I'll share with you my simple method for creating a happy, balanced dog. But first, I want to address the most serious cases I'm called in to help rehabilitate. Cases of red zone aggression. Chapter 6. Dogs in the Red Zone. Dangerous aggression. Imagine this. You come home to your upscale apartment building after doing a little grocery shopping. The elevator stops at your floor and the door slides open. The first and last things you see are two snarling 120-pound Presa Canario Mastiffs breaking away from their owner's leash and charging straight toward you. That's how life ended for Diane Whipple, a 33-year-old lacrosse coach in San Francisco, in January of 2001. The dog's owners were both convicted of involuntary manslaughter and served four-year prison terms. This was perhaps the most notorious dog attack death in the United States, but it's not the only one by far. 18 people, on average, die each year in this country from dog attacks. We spend more than $165 million treating the nearly 1 million serious dog bites that occur every year. Dog bites result in approximately 44,000 facial injuries in U.S. hospitals. And tragically, 60% of facial dog bite victims are children. Most of the dogs responsible for these bites will end up as statistics. Just part of the 2.7 million animals put to death in shelters every year. Remember, these animals did not premeditate their attacks. They weren't born killers, nor did they suddenly turn into killing machines. Unlike a human murderer sentenced to death for his crimes, none of these dogs had a sense of right or wrong about taking a life, whether human or animal. As I've said before, there is no morality in the animal kingdom. There is only survival. If dogs lash out in violence, they are acting on their fight-or-flight survival instincts. Dangerous aggression is not the cause. It's the outcome of a dog's serious behavioral issues. And, more often than not, a violent dog's aggressive behavior has been deliberately exacerbated or even nurtured by the very human beings who are allegedly its caretakers. In the wild, dogs are natural predators. They are also hardwired to physically defend their territories. But aggression against humans or other dogs should never be permitted in the domestic dogs that live with us. Never. If we are to be our dog's pack leaders, the first rule of the pack should be no violent aggression. I made my reputation as a specialist in dog behavior by rehabilitating some of the most formidable dog breeds out there. Pit bulls, Rottweilers, Boxers, and German Shepherds. I love these brawny breeds, but they are definitely not appropriate for all owners. Unfortunately, when a dog owner can't handle his high-energy, powerful breed dog, the owner, the dog, and sometimes innocent bystanders suffer. I believe that more than 90% of the time, what I call red zone aggression is preventable. The majority of cases where I'm called in to help involve some kind of aggressive behavior, and in more than 20 years of working with dogs, I've met only two red zone cases that I believed could not be rehabilitated as social animals that could live safely with humans. Based on my own experience, maybe 1% of all the dogs who've come to me with aggression issues have a mental imbalance or are so deeply damaged by humans that they can't safely be returned to society. The upshot of this is we're putting a lot of animals to death who don't deserve to die. The only crimes these dogs committed were ending up with the wrong human caretakers. Defining the red zone. I never encountered a dog in the red zone until I came to the United States. I'd seen rabid dogs and dogs physically fighting with each other. But once one dog had established dominance by putting the other to the ground, usually the contest ended right there. In nature, threatening behavior usually serves to deter outright aggression. Unless an animal is weak and must be executed by the pack, it is in the pack's best interest to keep aggression to a minimum. Before I arrived here, I'd never seen a dog that didn't stop his aggressive behavior, pinning another dog to the ground, or chasing or scaring a person away, after getting a warning bite. But the red zone was something else entirely. The red zone means killing, be it another animal or a human being. It's not a dominant or territorial thing. The intention of that dog is to assault its target until he exhausts it, until there is no life left in it. A red zone case won't listen to you, even if you are holding on to him. It doesn't matter if this dog is your lifelong companion who sleeps in the same bed with you. Once that red light goes on, it's as if you didn't exist. The dog will struggle against you and would rather die than cease his attack. You can hit him, yell at him. He won't hear you. He's that focused. His mission to kill overpowers any pain you might inflict, and in fact, striking or screaming at a dog in the red zone will only accelerate or intensify his lethal state of mind. He's a dog with a fixation, but a deadly one. A red zone case is never something that happens overnight. That's why it is so tragically preventable. Ticking time bombs. I had no idea that he would ever do anything like that. How could you anticipate something like that? A totally bizarre event. How can you anticipate that a dog that you know, that is gentle and loving and affectionate, can do something so horrible and brutal and disgusting and gruesome? Those were the words owner Marjorie Knoller spoke in her own defense at the Diane Whipple murder trial. Ironically, Knoller and her partner Robert Noel seemed to be the only ones in their San Francisco neighborhood who hadn't anticipated such a bizarre reaction from their Preso Canario Mastiff mix pair, Bane and Hera. These dogs were already in the red zone by the time the two lawyers adopted them, and in the words of a veterinarian who sent Knoller and Noel a warning letter about the dogs, they were ticking time bombs just waiting to go off. The story of this senseless and preventable death began with a Folsom prison inmate whom attorneys Knoller and Noel were representing, and whom, for whatever reason, they ended up adopting as their son. This inmate was trying to start an illegal Preso Canario breeding business from his cell. Powerful dog breeds like Presas, Cane Corsos, and Pit Bulls are exploited because of their extreme strength and territorial tendencies, and unfortunately are often condemned to lives as gladiators in illegal dogfights or as guards for crack houses, meth labs, and other criminal activities. In the San Francisco case, the two Presses, Bain and Hera, had been kept for the inmate by a woman who had a farm near Folsom Prison. After they attacked and killed some chickens, sheep, and a cat, the woman decided she didn't want anything more to do with them. While she and the other people on the farm cowered in fear, the two dogs were kept chained up in a remote corner of the property, which only served to increase their frustration and aggression. Eventually, the inmate persuaded his two city-dwelling lawyers to adopt the dogs. Once they had experienced killing the weak farm animals, Bain and Hera were already deep into the red zone. No one on the farm corrected them after they killed. They just banished them to their corner. Then the dogs were brought to the city and taken in by inexperienced owners to live in a one-bedroom apartment where their pent-up frustration continued to build. They got lots of affection from the two lawyers, but the way they reciprocated the affection was by jumping all over their owners, by dominating them. The lawyers did seem to walk them frequently, but the dogs were always out in front, dragging the owners along and dominating them during the walk. After the tragedy occurred, several witnesses came forward to describe having seen Marjorie Noller chasing after the dogs as they pulled her on their leashes, totally out of control. In the city, there were no goats or chickens for these dogs to target. Most of the weak energy they sensed there came from human beings. When the dogs were in the apartment building elevator, all they had to do was snarl, and people would back away from the elevator and refuse to enter it. People shrank back in fear whenever they saw these two formidable dogs on the street. This cause and effect intensified both dogs' dominant states of mind. To them, a human projecting fear was no different from a chicken or a goat projecting fear. Fear is fear. It's weak energy. No one had blocked their dominant aggressive behavior when they attacked the animals on the farm, and no one was blocking it now. The dogs had no idea why the woman at the farm had gotten rid of them. They knew only that dominant aggressive behavior was how they had learned to survive and gotten their way. So why should they change their behavior now? I wish I could turn back the clock and start this terrible story over. I'd begin by conditioning these dogs from day one that aggression is not acceptable. Period. To do this with such a powerful breed of dog, however, requires an enormous amount of work and energy. Ideally, these dogs should have been getting 4 to 8 hours of primal activities and exercise every day. They should have been socialized from the time they were puppies to accept other animals and other dogs as members of their pack, and humans, and especially children, as pack leaders. Humans should not have been conditioning them to engage in dominance games such as tug-of-war and wrestling. As the dogs got older, they were always going to win such games, thus increasing their perception of their own dominance. Their owners should never have used pain to inflict punishment. These dogs needed exceptionally strong, consistent, calm, assertive humans as their pack leaders. For those who would argue that the dog's breed was at fault, it is indeed true that Presses, Cane Corsos, Pit Bulls, and Rottweilers were all originally bred to be canine gladiators. But they are animals and dogs first, before breed. That same powerful energy can be redirected and channeled into other activities. Humans were gladiators in the past, too. But today we redirect that energy into basketball, baseball, soccer, football, and hockey. Presa Canarios were originally bred to be guard dogs, but they were also used by the Spanish to herd. Herd dogs don't kill their flock. Presas and their relatives have, in the recent past, made excellent show dogs. Their physical and psychological energy has been redirected into their performance in the ring. Breed doesn't necessarily have to shape a dog's behavior, but powerful breed dogs have special needs and require special people to care for them. Dedicated and responsible people. Unfortunately, these two lawyers were not equipped to deal with these powerful animals. They took the dogs to obedience training, but as you know by now, learning to respond to commands does nothing to take away an unbalanced dog's fear, anxiety, nervousness, dominance, or aggression. The owners said they loved the dogs. But once again, affection isn't the most important thing our dogs need from us. They also need rules, boundaries, and limitations. And from what witnesses later said at the trial, it looks as if these dogs' owners were at worst negligent, or at best inconsistent with rules. One neighbor, who was bitten by one of the dogs, said that Robert Knowles' only comment after the incident was, that's interesting. Other witnesses described seeing the dogs threaten and attack other dogs as early as 2 days before the killing. A professional dog walker testified that when she asked Noel to muzzle his dogs, he told her to shut up and called her offensive names. Diane Whipple, the innocent victim, had also been bitten by one of the dogs, and since that day had been deathly afraid of them, going out of her way to avoid them in the building. The dog's owners not only didn't apologize to her after that incident, but more important, they also never sought professional help to see to it that the dogs would be comfortable with Whipple and safe for her to be around them in the future. The owners did absolutely nothing, thus ensuring that the next time the dogs encountered Whipple's fearful energy, she would again be a target. The attack on Whipple was the stuff that horror movies are made of. It lasted from 5 to 10 minutes, and the medical examiner said that only the soles of Whipple's feet and the top of her scalp were left intact. She died at the hospital within 4 hours of the attack. Two more unnecessary deaths resulted from the tragedy. Both Bain and Hera were put down. Bain, the male, was euthanized on the day of the attack. I offered my services to try to rehabilitate Hera. These dogs were not born killers. Humans had taught them to be that way. But even though I believe Hera might have had a chance at rehabilitation, by that point public outcry had sealed her fate. Even if I had been able to turn her behavior around, no one would have trusted her again. Creating a monster. I've said before that pack leaders are born, not made. Red zone dogs are just the opposite. Made, not born. Humans create dogs to be red zone monsters. We started thousands of years ago by breeding dogs to be fighters, selecting them for certain characteristics and matching them up with a similar mate. Pit bulls and bull terriers were bred in the Victorian era for combat in the ruthless sports of dog fighting and bull baiting. They were selected for their ability to clamp onto a foe with powerful jaws, holding on with relentless pressure. Rottweilers are descendants of ancient Roman drover dogs. They traveled with the Roman army as it fought its way across the European continent, guarding the army's gigantic herds of cattle by fighting off wolves and other predators. During his invasion of Britain in 55 BC, Julius Caesar described the ancestors of the Mastiff breeds fighting alongside their masters. These dogs showed such bravery that they were brought back to Rome and pitted against other dogs, bulls, bears, lions, tigers, and even human gladiators in the Circus Maximus. These ancient Mastiffs were the ancestors of Bane and Hera, the Presa Canarios that killed Diane Whipple. We breed these dogs to be warriors, but under their armor, they're simply dogs with more powerful weapons than other dogs. They don't begin life as dangerously aggressive. We can socialize them as puppies to get along with kids, humans, even cats and other animals. Though fighting is in their genes, they need guidance to bring this instinct out. In modern America, dogfighting is illegal, but it is much more common than you might think. Dogmen, pit bull breeders, believe that the only way to preserve the line of pure American pit bull terriers is to prove their gameness, their ability to fight to the death. These men engage in a sport known as game testing, throwing their dogs into a ring with another dog and culling out the ones that manage to survive but that don't perform to the breeder's standards. These losing dogs are either killed by their owners or abandoned, left to wander the streets. Sometimes they're lucky and are picked up by a rescue organization. Usually they're picked up by animal control and eventually put down if a home can't be found for them. Usually for the simple reason that they happen to be wearing the outfit of a pit bull, a presa, or a rottie. And sometimes they attack and kill other dogs or people. It has also become fashionable and macho for gang members to have big tough dogs at their sides, which they wield like four-legged artillery. Illegal dog fighting has grown to become a popular activity for some gangs. Betting on which dog will make it out of the pit alive is a thriving form of gambling. Dog fighting isn't confined to gangs and criminals, however. According to the New York Daily News, in the United States, an upscale dogfight underground exists in which thousands of dollars change hands. "We're like a secret society in the last sport that's out there," boasts an unnamed source quoted in the article. "We've got all walks of life involved, celebrities, Wall Street brokers, ordinary people." No matter where these dogfighters come from, what's scary is that those who get off on this blood sport sometimes bring their kids along to watch, creating a vicious circle of brutality. They're desensitizing a new generation to cruelty to animals and to violence in general. People who raise pit bulls, presa canarios, cane corsos, or other dogs for fighting turn these innocent dogs into killers by abusing them. When they're young, the dogs are never allowed to be puppies. They have to be warriors all the time. The owners will start smacking the dog in the head at an early age, putting hot sauce on his food, teasing him, letting him be attacked by a bigger dog, all because they believe that this treatment will make the dog tough. They will punch him and pinch him repeatedly until he bares his teeth, at which point they'll stop pinching him. In this way, he learns to bare his teeth for self-preservation. They'll buy chickens and let the dog chase one while praising him. Then they'll tie the chicken up so the dog can learn to kill. The dog has absolutely no choice in the matter. When the dog is no longer useful to the owner, they'll discard him like trash, often dumping him in a vacant lot or leaving him by the side of the road. That's why you'll see so many powerful breeds, pit bulls and pit bull mixes, boxers, Rottweilers, Mastiffs, and German Shepherds in shelters. Many times, they are considered unadoptable and will eventually be put to sleep. My Dog Psychology Center is home to many such dogs that were judged lost causes before they came to me for rehabilitation. Some of these lost causes are now living happily with human families, or have productive jobs with police or search and rescue organizations. For people who raise pit bulls or other dogs for illegal activities, it's all about looking good. They feel that if they walk around with a very muscular dog with scars and cropped ears and a chain around his neck, they're going to look rough and tough and have status immediately as a real bad guy. Fortunately for their dogs, or at least for the ones who survive to get a chance at rehabilitation, these bad guys are also bad dog trainers and handlers. First of all, they start the abuse at an early age, making the dog more traumatized about fighting than desiring to fight. The dogs actually become very fearful, anxious, and tense about fighting. They fight only out of fear, out of fight-or-flight response. Their owner's ineffectiveness is why I have such great success rehabilitating such dogs. First, I invite the dogs to go into a calm state of mind. The animal in them immediately recognizes that this is a far better situation than the one they've been living in. Unlike humans, who have the power or curse of denial to keep them in an abusive situation, animals will always move toward balance. Automatically, the brain says, "Hey, finally, I get a rest." They are relieved.